Chapter 2. I followed the little human's persistent, quick pace through low brush and past the naked, scaly trunks of many palms, topped with bristling, branching crowns. The undergrowth was not thick, but it was regular. Too regular. The pathways, if any, were invisible to me. Shakas followed a few steps behind, wearing a perpetual light smile, as if preparing to unleash some joke upon us both. I had not yet learned how to read human expressions with confidence. Grinning might mean mild amusement. It might also be a prelude to aggression. The air was humid, the sun high, and our water, carried in tubes made from a kind of thick-stemmed grass, was warm. It was also running out. The Hamanune passed one of the last tubes around. Forerunners can't catch human diseases, or any diseases, if they wear armor, but only reluctantly did I share the warm liquid. My good mood faded. Something odd and unexpected was in the air. Without my armor, I was discovering instincts I didn't know I could trust. Old talents, old sensitivities, hidden until now by technology. We paused. The Florian noticed my growing irritation. "Make hat," he told Shakas, wiggling his fingers. "Forerunner has hair like glass. Sunburns his head." Shakas looked up, shading his eyes, and nodded. He glanced at me, sizing up my head, before shinnying up a naked trunk. Halfway, he husked off a dried branch and tossed it down. The little one chuffed. I watched Shakas finish his inchworm ascent. At the top, he pulled a knife from his rope belt and hacked loose a green branch, also letting it drop. Then he shinnied back down, leaping the last half and landing on bent legs with a wide-armed flourish. In triumph, he raised his hand to his mouth and lipped a musical blatting sound. We paused in the shadow of the tree while he wove my head cover. Forerunners are fond of hats. Each form, rate, and maniple has their own ceremonial designs, worn only on special occasions. On one day, during grand star season, however, all wear the same style of headgear. Our hats were much more dignified and lovely than what Shakas finally handed me. Still, I placed it on my head and found that it fit. Shakas put his hands on his hips and surveyed me with a critical mien. "Good," he judged. We continued on for hours until we came to a low wall assembled from precisely cut lava stones. The wall pushed between the trees. From above, it would have ascribed a sinuous curve like a serpent crawling through the jungle. Reiser sat on the wall, crossed his legs, and chewed on a green blade left over from my hat. His head turned slowly, large brown eyes shifting right and left, and he pushed out his lips. The Hamanune had no chin, nothing at all like the prominent feature that made Shakas bear a resemblance to my kind. But the little human more than made up for this with his elegant, mobile lips. "Old ones did this. Older than grandfather," he said, patting the stones. He tossed aside the green shred, then stood and balanced on the wall, arms out. "You follow. Only Hamanune walk on top." Reiser ran along the top. Shakas and I followed on either side, pushing aside brush and avoiding the occasional pugnacious land crustaceans that stood aside for nobody, waving their powerful claws. I almost walked through them until I remembered I had no armor. Those claws could take off a part of my foot. How vulnerable I was to everything. The excitement of adventure was starting to wear thin. The two humans had done nothing overtly threatening, but how long could I count on that? We had a tough time keeping up with the little Florian. A few hundred meters later, the wall branched. Reiser paused at the juncture to study the situation. He swung his arm right. The chase resumed. Through thicker trees on our left, I saw the inland beach. We had crossed the ring. Beyond loomed the central peak, surrounded by the Ring Island's inner lake. the hole shaping a kind of archery target within the crater. I wondered if Merce lived in those waters as well. My mind wandered. Perhaps a powerful, ancient precursor vessel had crashed down from space, and the central peak was an effect of waves of molten rock lapping inward before solidifying. I wished now I had spent more time listening to my swap father's tales of how planets formed and changed, but I didn't share his miner's fascination with tectonics, except where it might conceal or reveal treasure. Some precursor artifacts were old enough to be cycled again and again through hundreds of millions of years, dragged down with subsumed crust, and pushed up again through volcanoes or vents. Indestructible. Fascinating. And, for now, useless. Shakus was bold enough to poke me. I flinched away. "You wouldn't do that if I still had my armor," I said. His teeth gleamed. Was he becoming more aggressive, or was this just his way of showing affection? I had no way of judging. "Over here," Reiser called from where he had run ahead. We broke through a particularly dense patch of twiggy green trees with bright red trunks and branches. The Florian was waiting for us, where the long, low wall came to an abrupt end. Beyond lay a flat white plain, the inner lake on one side, its beach forming a line of black and gray, and jungle on the other. Once again, the central peak was revealed, naked of vegetation, like a dead black thumb thrusting from the pale greenish-blue center of the target.
"Okay, young Forerunner," Shakus said, coming up behind me.
I turned swiftly, believing for a moment he was about to knife me, but no. The bronze-colored human simply pointed across the white waste.
"You asked? We brought you here. Your fault, not ours. Remember that."
"There's nothing here," I said, looking across the flats. Heat waves broke the outline of the far side of the waste into velvety shimmers.
"Look again," Reiser suggested.
At the base of the shimmers, what seemed like more water was in fact refracted sky. But through the shimmers, I thought I saw a line of large, hulking apes. Great white apes, no doubt from the low end of the librarian's folly. They came and went with the mirage, and then steadied. Not alive, but frozen. Carved from stone and left to stand out on the flats like pieces on a game board. A cooling wind whispered outward from the black peak, brushing away the rising heat, and the ape figures vanished. Not a mirage, after all, something more deceptive. I bent to pick up a bit of the soil, coral and white sand mixed with fine, hard volcanic ash. The whole area smelled faintly of ancient fire. I looked between the human guides, speechless.
"Walk,"
Reiser suggested. The walk to the center of the white waste took longer than I expected, but soon enough it dawned on me that we were crossing a baffler, a place protected by geometric distortions, or at the very least, a dazzler protected by delusions. A Forerunner had apparently long ago decided the waste should be hidden from curious eyes. I shaded my eyes and looked up at the blue lid of sky. That meant it probably couldn't be seen from above either. Minutes passed into an hour. We couldn't keep to a straight line. We were most likely walking in circles. Still, we kept on. My feet, shod in ill-fitting human sandals, crunched lightly. Sharp grains dug at my sensitive soles and crept between my toes. The two humans showed great patience and did not complain. Shakus lifted the Hamanune to his shoulders when it became apparent the little one's bare feet were suffering from the hot sand. The last of our water tubes gave out. Reiser tossed it aside with a resigned wicker, then looked back at me, covering and uncovering his eyes with one hand. I thought this was a sign of embarrassment. But he did it again, then gave me a stern look. Shakus explained,
"He wants you to blinker yourself. It helps."
I covered my eyes.
"Keep walking," Shakus said. "If you stop, we might lose you."
I couldn't help lifting my hands to peek.
"Don't look, walk blind,"
Reiser insisted.
"We're walking in circles," I warned.
"Such circles,"
Reiser enthused. The sun was affecting them. I felt like I was in charge of a pair of heat-stroked humans.
"Left," Shaka shouted. "Left, now."
I hesitated, lifted my hands, and saw my two guides, several paces ahead of me, abruptly vanish, as if swallowed by empty air. They had abandoned me in the middle of the flat, surrounded by white sand and distant jungle. Off to my right rose a lumpy blur that might or might not be the central peak. I braced myself for the worst. Without armor, without water, I'd die out here in days. Shakus reappeared on my left. He took my arm. I shook him loose instantly, and he stood back like a flattened cutout, his edges loose and seeming to flap. Blinking did not clear this apparition.
"Suit yourself," he said. "Turn left or go home, if you can find your way out of here."
Then he vanished again. I slowly turned left, took a step, and felt my entire body shiver. I now stood on a low black walkway, curving to the right and then back to the left, surrounded on both sides by gritty white sand. So it had been a baffler and not a dazzler. A forerunner had hidden this place long ago, using outdated technology, as if expecting that the old tech would be penetrated by clever, persistent humans. Ahead, clearly visible now, not white apes, but 12 mid-size forerunner fighting suits, arranged in a wide oval about 100 meters across the long axis. I had spent long hours studying old weapons and ships to better distinguish them from more interesting finds. Swallowing back disappointment, I recognized them as war sphinxes, flown into battle by warrior servants in ages past, but now found only in museums. Antiques, to be sure, and possibly still active and powerful, but of no interest to me whatsoever.
"Is that all you have to show me?" I asked,
indignant. Shakus and Reiser kept out of reach, posing in postures of reverence as if engaged in prayer. Odd. Humans praying to antique weapons? I turned my eyes back to the frozen circle. Each war sphinx was 10 meters high and 20 long, larger than contemporary forerunner suits that served the same function. An elongated tail contained lift and power, and from that, at the front, rose a thick, rounded torso. Atop the torso, smoothly integrated with the overall curvilinear design, perched an abstract head with a stubborn, haughty face, a command cabin. I took a step forward, deciding whether to cross the remaining stretch of flat between the walkway and the white giants arranged around the center of the waist. Shakus lifted his crossed arms and sighed.
"Reiser, how long have these monsters been here?"
"Long time," Reiser said. "Before Grandfather flew away to polish the moon."
"He means more than 1,000 years, Shakus interpreted. "You read old Forerunner writing?" he asked me.
"Some," I said. "This place doesn't like humans," Reiser said.
He pulled back his lips and shook his head vigorously.
"But Grandfather caught bees in a basket."
"You're telling him the secret?" Shakus asked in dismay.
"Yes," Reiser said. "He's not smart, but he's good."
"How can you tell?"
Reiser showed his teeth and shook his head vigorously.
"Grandfather put bees in a big basket. When they buzz loud, stop and wave the basket this way, then that. When they stop buzzing, go that way.
You mean there are markers? Infrared markers? I asked.
What you say, Reiser agreed with a pout. Bees know. If you live, you drop rocks so others can follow, as far as you make it.
Now that I knew what to look for, I saw, through the dazzle, that there were indeed broken, veering lines of small pebbles marking the otherwise smooth white sand. Reiser guided us along this jagged path, pausing now and then to chitter to himself, until we stood just a few meters from the nearest sphinx. I paused in its shadow, then leaned over and reached out to touch the high white surface, pitted with centuries of battle debris and stardust. No response. Inert. Towering over me, the scowling features were still impressive. They're dead, I said. Reiser's voice took on a tone of some reverence.
They sing, he said. Grandfather heard.
I drew my hand back.
He said these are trophies from war, important to old big guy. Somebody put them here to guard. Watch. Wait.
Which war, I wonder? Shakas asked, and looked at me as if I might know. I did know, or strongly suspected. The Sphinxes were about the right age to be from the human forerunner wars, 10,000 years or so. But I still did not feel comfortable discussing this with my guides. Reiser left the walkway and walked carefully around the fighting unit. I went next, observing the smooth points of the suit's forked tail, the gaping tunnels on each fork leading no doubt to thrusters. There were no visible guidance points. On the opposite side, I noticed the outlines of retracted manipulators and folded shields. Locked down for thousands of years, I said. I doubt they're worth anything.
Not to me, Reiser said, looking up at the younger, taller human with pouched lips.
To him, maybe,
Shaka said softly, waving at the center of the oval, an empty stretch of distorted sand.
Or her.
Him or her? I asked.
Who chose you? Who guided you?
Shakas asked.
Do you mean the librarian?
I asked.
She comes to us when we're born, Shakas said, his face dark with indignation and something more. She watches over us as we grow, knows good and bad. She joys at our triumphs and sorrows at our passing. We all feel her presence.
We all do, Reiser affirmed. We've been waiting for just the right time and just the right fool.
No doubt under her protection, these humans had grown arrogant and presuming. But there was nothing I could do. I needed them.
She's out there?
I asked, pointing at the central peak. We never see her, Shaka said. We don't know where she is, but she sent you. I'm sure of that.
My Ancilla. They were more right than they could possibly know.
She must be a great power indeed to arrange all this, I said. But my voice lacked conviction. Luck is her way, Shaka said. Once again, old forerunners were conspiring to guide my life. Reiser bent and waved his hand over what appeared to be an empty span of sand. This motion pushed aside a low mist, revealing for a moment a single, large, flat lump of black lava.
Good for walls.
We stepped over the rock, onto the central oval, bordered by the sphinxes. Suddenly I felt a chill, an awareness that I was on a space sacred not to humans,
but to some other power. Something great and old was nearby. A forerunner, of that I was sure, but of what race? Given the Sphinxes, a warrior servant seemed most likely, but how old?
From the Human Wars.
10,000 years ago.
Don't like it here, Reiser said. Not brave like Grandfather. You go on, I stay.
Follow the pebbles and the rocks, Shakus said quietly. Where the rocks stop, no human has ever stepped and lived. What needs to be done, I can't do, nor can Reiser.
The young human was sweating, his eyes unfocused. The Forerunner universe has a rich history of impossibilities that became truth. I considered myself a pragmatist, a realist, and found most such stories unsatisfying, frustrating, but never frightening. Now I was not only irritated, I was frightened. Far more frightened than I had been on the boat. When Forerunners die, usually by accident or on rare occasions during war, elaborate ceremonies are enacted before their remains are disposed of in fusion fires associated with the activities of their rates, a melting torch or planet cutter. First, the Forerunner's last memories are abstracted from his armor, which preserves a few hours of the occupant's mental patterns. This reduced essence, a spectral snatch of personality and not a whole being, is placed in a time-locked durance. The body is then torched in a solemn ceremony attended only by close relations. A bit of plasma from the immolation is preserved by the appointed master of the mantle, who secures it along with the essence in the durance. The durance is then given to the closest members of the dead Forerunner's family, who are charged with making sure that it is never abused. A durance has a half-life of more than 1,000,000 years. Families and rates are very protective of such places. In the treasure-hunting manuals I had read over the years, seekers are frequently warned to observe the signs and avoid such locations. Stumbling upon such a family durance would definitely be considered sacrilege. This is a disgraceful world, I murmured. No Forerunner would want to be buried here. Shakus set his jaw and glared at me. It's all nonsense, I persisted. No high rate would be buried here. Besides, what treasure would possibly be kept near a grave? I continued, drawing my arrogant words to a stronger point. And if you never met the librarian, how...
When I first met you, I knew you were the one, Shaka said. She comes to us at birth.
You said that.
And tells us what we must do.
How could she know what I'd look like?
Shakus dismissed this.
We owe our lives to the librarian. All of us.
A life worker as powerful as the librarian certainly had the means to impose a generations-long genetic command upon the objects of her study. Such a compulsion in past times would have been called Agaeus. Some students of the mantle even believed that the precursors had imposed Agaeus upon Forerunners. I was regretting more and more leaving my armor on the boat. I desperately needed to ask my Ancilla how these humans would know to expect me.
What will you do if I go home now and give up this quest?
Behind us, Reiser snorted.
Shaka smiled.
This smile displayed not humor, nor a prelude to aggression, but contempt, I think.
If we're so weak and our world is so disgraceful, what are you afraid of?
Dead things, Reiser said.
Forerunner dead.
Our dead?
Our friendly.
Well, my ancestors can stay in the ground and I'd be happy enough, Shakus admitted.
Their words stung. With an abrupt hitch of confidence, and perhaps even a slight swagger, I began walking toward the center of the circle, parting the mist with swings of my foot, looking for the pebbles laid by earlier generations of Hamanune. I must have seemed to be dancing my way toward the center, watched with sullen disapproval by the oval of inward-facing war sphinxes. Ancient weapons, ancient war. The sphinxes bore the scars of ancient battles, wars that no one cared about anymore. I looked over my shoulder. Shakus leaned casually against the prow of a sphinx. The machine's stern visage glowered over him like a disapproving priest. It takes a great deal to provoke my people to war. But once provoked, the war is carried out ruthlessly, totally, by our warrior servants. There is a kind of embarrassment in that slow rise to total fury that forerunners do not like to acknowledge. It goes against the very mantle that we so strive to inherit and hold. But to defy the forerunners is, after all, to show contempt for the mantle itself. Perhaps that was the case here. Monuments of the past. Hidden passions, hidden violence, hidden shame. The shadows of forgotten history. About 20 meters from the center of the circle, a sidewise kick of my sandaled foot revealed another low black wall. Beyond the wall, there were no more pebbles, no more markers. I knelt to push my hand into the sand and sift it between my fingers. The sand flowed back, smooth again, unmarked. But in my palm, the sand had left a bizarre gift. I turned it in my fingers. A chip of bone. My footprints had made no trace. The sand did not cling to my shoes or my feet, and not one grain stuck to my palms, my skin, anywhere. A sand pit built to withstand storms and intrusions, built for the ages, never to be erased, never to be completely forgotten. Designed to kill any intruder who did not follow precise rituals. Anyone not wanted here. Above me, something blotted out the sky. I had been studying the sand so intently that I neither felt the ground effect nor heard the subtle rushing sound of a ship until its shadow passed over and I jerked my gaze upward. As I had feared, one of my swap father's mining ships had found me. Reluctant to face the shame of losing me, my surrogate family had sent search parties throughout the system, looking for their ward. I stood straight, waiting for the ship to descend, waiting to be lifted into the hold and swifted away before I even had an inkling why I was here. I spun about and looked out at the circle of war machines. Shakus and Riser were nowhere to be seen. They might have dropped below the mist, or run back through the Dazzler heading for the trees. The mining ship was an ugly thing, sullen, entirely practical. Its belly was studded with unconcealed grapplers, lifters, cutters, churners. If the master of this craft so desired, its engines could easily convert all of Jamonkin Crater into a steaming tornado of whirling rock and ore. Sifting, lifting, and storing whatever components it wished to carry back. I hated what it stood for. I hated it all. The vessel continued its slow, steady glide over the crater. The sand did not dimple beneath the pressure of its lifters. The rocks did not shiver. I heard nothing but a subtle rush, like wind through the trees. I dropped my shoulders and knelt in submission. No choice. I might escape again, but I doubted it. After a while, the opposite blurred edge of the ship's shadow crossed my body, and sunlight spread again to the other side of the sandy waste. The mining craft rose slowly with lumbering grace, then sped up and flew over the peak, moving on. I could not believe my good fortune. Perhaps the island's deception could hide us from the deep-seeking probes of a mining ship.
My relief was short-lived. I heard a melodic wail. Shakas and Riser had joined in hideous song. That made no sense at all. The sand, which had withstood the immense pressure of the miner, now whirled under my feet and upended me. Ripples pushed out, lifting me like a wave. I fell on my side and was swept around in a spiral toward the stone wall. I scraped up hard against the rough lava. The motion stopped, but a precisely hemispheric hollow dropped in front of me. At its center, a white cylinder topped with a black stone capital slowly rose to a height of more than 50 meters. Shakas and Riser stopped their wailing. The island fell silent. It had no opinion, made no comment. The miner vessel had dropped out of sight behind the peak, then turned north, and was now almost over the horizon. My companions reappeared, standing up through the low mist. Riser ran out along the markers, arms held out in swinging balance, and stood on the inner wall, looking down on me. He squatted, toes poking over the edge. "Big," he said, "looking for you?" "It's not easy concealing anything from a minor ship," I observed. "They scan hard and deep."
"Special place," Riser said.
Shakas was striding toward us, picking his teeth again with a palm fiber, a gesture he seemed to think revealed sophistication.
"It worked,"
he said, shading his eyes.
"You sang to make it go away?" I asked.
"No song,"
Riser said. They looked at each other, shrugged their shoulders. I turned back to examine the column sticking up from the hollow. Definitely Forerunner, but far too prominent for a Durance. In color and shape, it seemed to fit the severe style of a marker one might find outside a temple of battle, commemorating regret and eternal sorrow. A military monument was certainly more in tune with the war sphinxes. I walked toward the hollow and stood on the rim for a moment, considering my options. The island had been visited frequently by Hamanune. They had explored, built walls, laid down trails, kept defying the Dazzler. I rolled the bone chip in my fingers. Then, as if giving up, the humans had departed, leaving the island to brood on its own enigma. Of late, however, visitors, mostly Florians, I guessed, had again begun to cross the Mersfield Lake, as if in anticipation of a change, an awakening, following their Gaius. The librarian had obviously tuned these peoples for a particular, very difficult task. And now, song. We were all being set up. I could feel it, but to what purpose? The pair watched with curious expectancy from the inner wall.
"Any ideas?" Shakas called.
"Go ahead," Riser suggested, waving his fingers. "It welcomes you."
"You don't know that,"
Shakas said to the Florian.
"I know it,"
Riser insisted.
"Go down, touch it."
I had studied just about every source on precursor myths and treasure. But now I was working hard to remember other tales. Tales I had heard in my youth of the strange practices of a high class of warrior servants known as Prometheans. Practices antiquated and rarely seen today, that is, in the times of my family. Practices involving sequestration and self-exile. In the archives of treasure seekers, such tales were inevitably followed by warnings. If one should come across something called a cryptum, or a warrior keep, one should leave it alone. Violating a cryptum, whatever it was, came with nasty consequences, not the least of which involved angering the highly protective guild of warrior servants. That could also explain why the miner ship had moved on. For possibly the first time in my life, I decided to do a little thinking before taking any reckless action.
I stepped back from the hollow, joined the humans at the wall, and sat beside Shakus. He lifted his palm frond hat and wiped his forehead.
Too hot for you? He asked.
Your yelling, your song, where did you learn that?
No song, Riser said again.
He looked puzzled.
Tell me more about the librarian, I said. She protects you. She marks you at birth. How does she mark you?
She doesn't mark us. She visits us, Shaka said. We're told who we are and why we're here. Even if it's not secret, it's hard to remember.
How many young Forerunner chumps have you brought to this place? I asked. Shakus grinned.
You're the first, he said,
and then backed off, as if I might hit him. The librarian told you to bring a Forerunner here, didn't she?
She watches over all,
Riser said, and smacked his lips.
Once we were great and many, now we are few and small. Without her, we would be dead.
Riser, your family has known this island for a long time, Shaka said. How long? 1,000 years?
Longer.
9,000 years?
Maybe.
Since the time the librarian had been given charge of Erde Tyrene. Since humans had been devolved and exiled here. A warrior keep, if that was what it was, hidden on a planet of exiles. I was detecting a pattern, but could not bring it into focus. Something about Forerunner politics and the human war. I had never cared much for that sort of history. Now I really missed my Ancilla. She could have retrieved what information I needed almost instantly. The sun was westering. Soon it would fall behind the central peak and we would be in shadow. Now, however, the Ring Island's heat was at its most intense, and I was getting uncomfortable sitting on the black wall surrounded by glaring white sand. Disciplined sand, made to stay here for the ages. I stood, my mind made up, and walked away from the hollow and the pillar. Take me back to the beach. Call the boat. The pair looked uncomfortable.
The boat won't return for days, Shaka said.
I suppose they would have been glad to strand a silly Forerunner youth out here, making off with his armor, sneaking back to Mirantic. But it did not make sense for them to be stuck out here with their hapless victim. I squinted. The sun hurt my eyes. You didn't actually plan any of this, did you? I asked. Riser shook his head. Shakus made a breeze on his face with his hat.
We thought you'd do something exciting.
We're still waiting, Riser said.
Where we live is boring, Shakus said. Out there?
He swept his hand up and around the vast, hot blueness.
Maybe you and me, we get crushed by sameness. Maybe you and me, we think alike.
Something stiffened my neck and made my head hurt, but it wasn't the last flashing glare of the sun. I could feel the two humans beside me, sitting quietly on the rock wall, patient, bored, heedless of danger. Like me in so many ways, too much like me. There are points in life when everything changes. And changes in a big way. The old sophistic texts refer to these points as synchrons. Synchrons supposedly tie great forces and personalities together. You can't predict them, and you can't avoid them. Only rarely can you feel them. They're like knots creeping forward on your string of time. Ultimately, they tie you to the great currents of the universe, bind you a common fate.
This whole crater is a mystery, Shaka said. I've dreamed about it all of my life. But if I step inside this circle or away from the maze lines, it will kill me. Whatever it is, it doesn't like humans. The sand climbs down our throats.
When we are dead, the sand climbs back out. Now we bring you, and everything changes. This place recognizes you. Why would anything valuable, or even interesting, be stuck out here on a world covered with humans? Go ask, Reiser suggested, pointing to the column. Whatever happens, we'll sing your story in the market. Dusk was upon us, but the air stayed hot and still. I knew that I had to go out to the pillar. If I couldn't handle a cryptum, then almost certainly, when the time came, my courage would fail me when I faced something much older and far stronger. I pushed off the wall and took a step. Then I looked back at the two humans. Do you feel it? I asked. Reiser circled two fingers and waggled them. Yes, without hesitation. But Shakas asked,
Feel what?
The ties that join us.
If you say so, Shakas said.
Liars, cheats, low beings, suitable only for being kept as specimens. Of course the sand would choke them. But not me.